other types of water management programs. Now, I'm going to skip to the SGMA new groundwater sustainability agency, and so these are the list of the members of this new sustainability agency that was formed. And Kern County initially took a very strong leadership role and helped fund the initial formation, and they transitioned the chair every year, and so now it's the City of Ridgecrest, and it'll be the district, and so on. And as I said, there's a policy advisory committee and a technical advisory committee. These groups all meet monthly, and so they're developing policy. They're struggling with all the things that everybody else is struggling with. Okay, now we've got a new agency. What are we doing, and how do we form this new plan? Fortunately, the Department of Water Resources came out with their grant award since, so that's going to help fund the sustainability plan. Just a little bit on the setting now. So this is a classic desert basin, closed basin, with most of the recharge occurring from mountain front, coming off the Sierra Nevada, which is on your left, kind of the north half of the picture. And groundwater mostly flows towards, there's a Playa Lake, China Lake, on the east side of the basin. Most of the water flows that direction, coming off the recharge. And it's, as was mentioned earlier, it's been declining for a foot and a half a year. The water balance out there, we're working on that. Estimates have been from 7 to 11,000 acre feet per year recharge, with about a 27,000, 28,000 acre foot per year pumping. So that's a pretty big deficit. A lot of that's occurring, agriculture is a large factor in that. And then also supply for the city and Navy is probably the other third, something like that. So those are the kind of things that we're currently struggling with. And as mentioned on the slide, it's a sole source of drinking water there, and groundwater sustainability plans being led by the authority. So salt nutrient management plan was initiated in 2015, and I think I came here in August 2016 last time, and a lot has happened in that time besides this salt nutrient management plan effort, and I'll try to fill you in on some of that related to the SGMA activities, because as you think about water quality issues and SGMA versus the existing water quality regulatory programs, merging those somehow and making sure they all work together is going to be something that hopefully the sustainability plan can do. So the technical analysis was conducted 2016 and 2017, and you can see there was a loading analysis, simulative capacity estimate, water quality trends in the future, and then anti-dig analysis as required under the policy that was implemented by the state board. And as I mentioned, now merging with SGMA. And so, keep track here. So it's a high-level planning document. I think that was one of the things we wanted to emphasize. And really focused on salinity and nutrients. And key parameters were established to be responsive to the recycled water policy, and larger water quality characterizations efforts are underway through the GSP studies, and I'll mention those, and then largely in part of the brackish water feasibility study that's going on there, and this has been merged into sort of part of this Stanford groundwater architecture project, which I'll try to touch on that a little bit. And then the modeling analysis was simplified for the salt nutrient management plan. The current reclaimed water use here is listed. So we've got the golf course and alfalfa largely, and then evaporation and percolation for environmental benefits. Bruce already mentioned these things and went into pretty good detail on it, the two-each chewy tub. Anyway, and then future plans for the plant are in the works. There's a feasibility study that's been completed, I think, and environmental documentation, and they're continuing to try to figure out where to put it is one of the key issues, and they're kind of stuck with the environmental requirements. So maybe not the ideal situation, but that's the way it is. And there's a recycled water study that's being implemented as part of the groundwater sustainability plan. And there's also the brackish water study. So we'll be having more information developed as things goes on. So the salt nutrient loading was occurring due to surface activities, as it does everywhere. So we've got irrigation water from largely produced from groundwater, and then the reclaimed water, and agricultural input from fertilizers, and then the typical residential inputs. So the process was to do the land use classifications, and I don't, you obviously can't read that, but basically the classifications are agriculture, and then the alfalfa and pistachios are the first two colors, the darker for the alfalfa, and you can see the circles along the 395 corridor, and then the green is the pistachios. So that's about 1,000 acres of alfalfa and 2,000 acres of pistachios. Then you've got urban, commercial, and industrial, the light color, light tan color. Urban residential is kind of the little bit, the in-between dark and light. And then you've got the urban low permeability surfaces, and then urban landscape is the darker color. It's kind of hard to read on these diagrams, but that's what we have. And the loading analysis was a step-by-step process. Estimating the crop demand using crop ET and regional effective ET based on the crop type, and adjusted based on the stakeholder input. We did go through and talk to agriculture to make sure they were all okay with the numbers we got. And then calculated the applied water by adjusting for irrigation efficiency and leaching. And then used nitrogen fertilizer application rates based on the crop type and the stakeholder input, adjusted for the nitrate uptake efficiency and volatilization, and then applied septic and wastewater treatment plant percolation loads, and applied the loading pounds per acre per year to land distribution to calculate the typical loading in the basin. So it's a pretty typical standard approach to do this loading, a spreadsheet kind of a model. And here are some of the results that we have, and these are pounds per acre per year in terms of TDS loading, and it goes from 250 down to greater than 5,000 is the color range, and then you can see the percent that came out in terms of the aerial loading for the basin. And so you can see the biggies are urban residential and pistachios, then alfalfa, then the wastewater treatment plant, urban golf course, septic, and then these low and commercial industrial surfaces. So that's basically the TDS loading, and you can kind of see where it's distributed as well. And then the next slide is actually the nitrate loading, and its nitrate is nitrogen per acre per year, and it goes from less than 0.5 to up to greater than 20, and you can see there's really not a lot of loading there. It's mostly coming from the pistachios, and I guess I don't have to explain the alfalfa now, because we had a really good explanation of that in the last presentation. And then we've got septic and urban residential weighing in as well. So that's the distribution. It's pretty big basin, and not a lot of loading, I think, is the message that we see here. So in terms of the existing water quality analysis, We used a data set that was compiled by the Navy in 2015 and 41 wells, and did some GIS spatial analysis for averaging the results. And overall, pretty good water quality for a desert basin with some minor hot spots for TDS. Not so much on the nitrogen, so that was good news, and relatively stable trends on TDS and nitrate. So that's a key message, is, you know, we don't see a lot of change going on. And this shows basically the TDS and the nitrate as nitrogen diagrams, and you can see the range in concentrations there and where they're distributed. So on to the assimilative capacity analysis. So we came up with the basin plan objective of 500 for the TDS and 10 for the nitrate. We had an available capacity of 130 for TDS and 9.3 for nitrate, and the existing average water quality of 310 and average existing water quality of 0.7 for the nitrate. So it's pretty clear cut in the numbers. And then the future water quality trend analysis, we used this spreadsheet mixing model. It was a lump model because we didn't have the data to look at it in more detail. So we did a water balance, the salt and nutrient loading, the mixing model, the future water quality and assimilative capacity to come up with an estimate of the assimilative capacity by the recycled water projects. And this estimates that the recycled project uses less than 10% of the available assimilative capacity, assuming a future use of 4,600 acre feet in 2040. Now, stepping back, you know, the state board put on some pretty conservation requirements, and so, you know, the recycled water has actually decreased as a result of that, and the future may be a decrease. So I would say this is a pretty conservative estimate on that basis alone. Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Future average TDS findings, this just shows a curve of the recycled water project, again, based on the 10% of available assimilative capacity, and the objectives will not be exceeded based on our estimated spreadsheet analysis. Increase from 310 to up to 446 and up to 452, assuming full recycled water capacity, but again, that's a pretty conservative considering the conservation requirements for now and in the future. And then on the nitrate, it's the same sort of a deal. Really, recycled water use less than 10% of the assimilative capacity, and they won't be exceeded. So we're pretty happy with the results there. Now I'm going to move on to some of the other things that are going on there in the basin. And I'm just going to put these all up here. Oop. Because I prefer not to do the line-by-line kind of description. That requires I have to stick to a script. But anyway, so we've got the agriculture is using best management practices by drip irrigation on the pistachios, and then alfalfa is being pretty well controlled, and we've got reclaimed wastewater capacities. Now, on the groundwater management side, there's a lot going on. The USGS has been working on a basin characterization model, which is their standard approach in desert basins for estimating the amount of natural recharge coming into the basin. So that's about to be wrapped up, so we'll be using that in the future groundwater sustainability plan and the water balance analysis. There's also the brackish water resources project. I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes on that because One of the things that we're doing related to that is trying to better understand the distribution of brackish water in the basin. So this GAP project I mentioned earlier that has Stanford as a lead, actually it's kind of an interesting one because it's being jointly funded by three basins, Indian Wells Valley, San Luis Obispo County, and then Butte County. They're putting in a third of the $2 million project. State Water Resources Control Board and Department of Water Resources are funding a third. And then the Kingdom of Denmark is funding a third. That's because they have an agreement. They signed an agreement with the governor's office. When was that? It was like a year ago. That was just last year, right? That was to share tools and technology. Turns out Denmark had their Sigma back in the early 90s, and some of the tools and technologies they've developed include aerial electromagnetics, time domain electromagnetics, and airborne are very good at looking at water quality, brackish water. So we've flown 500 linear miles of the basin with SkyTEM and are in the process, now that was done in November, and are in process of doing the inversion. Part of that involves having control points with geophysical logs with the same kind of data to help calibrate that data. And so we're in the process now of comprehensively taking all the well completion reports, which amount to somewhere on the order of 1,200, 100 electric logs, and digitizing all that information, bringing it to a data management system, and working with a Danish consultant to then bring that into a 3D conceptual model called GeoScene 3D. And so that is all going to be very helpful in terms of understanding the distribution of brackish water. The other thing is that we're actually selectively doing some additional e-logging in some of the plastic wells to have more geophysical information, and also going out and sampling additional wells focused on total dissolved solids. So we're going to have a lot better information on TDS in the basin. And that will get rolled into the GSP in the coming year and a half we have over there to complete it. So that pretty well summarizes some of the ongoing things. I mentioned the recycled water study that's part of the Sigma process, the GSP. There's also work going on to look at a potential imported water project. This brackish water project would really be, I don't want to call it short term, but it's a supplemental project as the basin looks at trying to ramp down pumping over the next 20 years. This could help supplement that by softening the landing over the next 20 years to use some of the brackish water. It won't help with the water balance, but it'll help spatially distribute the pumping and alleviate some of the depletion zones. So that's kind of the philosophy there. It's in a feasibility stage, and we're just signing a contract. The consultants are just signing a contract with the state to get a grant funding to help with that project. So moving on now to, I guess this, yeah, I'm just about wrapped up. So the monitoring plan, we've got a subset of wells that'll be sampled annually for the salt nutrient management plan. We'll be analyzing TDS, nitrate, electrical conductivity, general minerals, and physical constituent, and reporting triennially as required, and then incorporating that into the larger GSP monitoring program. And this may be an area where the water quality could be better incorporated into Sigma, where there isn't a lot of guidance or direction out there on how to do the water quality degradation sustainability criteria. It's one thing that we've been talking to DWR about as on a sort of a forum level in terms of how do we do that, one, and how do we integrate that with the existing regulatory programs? And so I think we're going to have some interesting dialogues there. And so we'll be meeting the salt nutrient management plan's objectives by continuing to conduct the salinity monitoring and through the brackish groundwater project, and eventually implement that project, which, by the way, will export high salinity water throughout the treatment residual out of the basin. That's one thing I didn't mention. So one of the pumpers in the basin is Searles Valley Minerals, who exports water over into Searles Valley. And there's also COSO Geothermal is in the COSO subbasin just to the north. Both of those organizations have expressed an interest in actually taking the residual from the brackish water project. So this is somewhat unique, where you have an opportunity to not have to pay for that residual. So it makes the project much more cost effective. And again, we've got a lot to do to stabilize groundwater level trends and the water balance there over the years. But anyway, so in closing, this is the finalization steps for the salt nutrient management plan, and gives just kind of steps through. So we reviewed with the GSA Technical Advisory Committee in December, and got comments through December, and this is recommended by staff for adoption, and so that's pretty well it. So I guess I'll turn it back over to Bruce now, and thank you for your attention.
First, questions.
Oh, sure.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Parker, could you explain how the brackish water program would relieve some of the demand on the potable water sources in the basin?
Sure. Well, it would really be shifting it, but the brackish water could be used, for example, by agriculture to instead of using fresh potable water. And so it would be actually just moving the pumping source over to the more brackish area and take that wet water. So it's not really going to change the water balance, but it will relieve some of the pumping in the areas where there are a couple of pumping depressions in the basin.
Is there a proposal to treat the brackish water?
Yes. Yes. So it would be treated. Right now, the feasibility studies aren't going, but because we've got a residual taker, it looks like it would be one pass RO is what we're looking at.
Why would this not be considered a new water resource? I mean, if enough of it is treated, could it satisfy the deficit?
Well, it's in the same basin, so you have to look at the basin as a whole. So it will relieve the pumping in the fresher water area, but it will not. When you do the water balance, you still got a pumping going on. So, you're going to be exporting a little bit too. So, and for example, it could also potentially be used by one of the organizations that offered to take the residual. So, anyway, that's the gist of it.
Okay. In general, would you say the soil percolation rates are low or high
They're low. I mean, it's the basin has a lot of clay based on its geologic development, and structurally it's pretty complex because it sits right at the southeast end of the Sierra Nevada. There's Sierra Nevada frontal fault, which caused the basin to be, dropped down, and that's where the sediments came in. It used to be all connected from Mono Mammoth, Rose Valley, Indian Wells, down to Searles, and this used to be kind of a waterway coming through there. And as a result, you've got this lake that formed and a lot of clay deposits up on the top. You've got coarser grained deeper in the system. And the most of the recharge is estimated to be coming from the Sierra Nevada frontal mountain front there, most of that recharge coming into the basin. So,
And did you say earlier that the general groundwater flow in the basin is from west to east?
Well, it's yeah, it's generally from west to east because the basin, the Playa Lakes on the east, so most of that water is coming from the southwest and west over to the east. Yep.
Do the Playa Lakes represent a demand on the flow? Do they, in what way do they influence the groundwater flow?
Well, they're a source of evapotranspiration, but that number has gone way down over time as the pumping has increased. And so the pumping has disrupted the general flow. And so that's one of the things that I didn't say was, you know, you've got these, the other discharges are the pumpers. And that's agriculture, the pistachios and alfalfa, Water District, the Navy, and then Searles Alley Minerals.
Okay, thank you. Very good presentation.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
Dr. Horn.
So I saw a news article that Indian Wells had received a grant from DWR? Or
yeah, Department of Water Resources.
Or
yeah.
State Board for the desalination plant?
Yes, for, yeah, brackish, this is for the brackish water feasibility study.
Okay, so I was just curious, I mean, you mentioned that the brackish study had to do with sort of softening the blow as pumping rates declined and to the
right.
Basin to get into, so what is the expected lifespan of that desalination plant?
You know, we're still kind of looking at that. It's a feasibility study in progress, but we've got a deadline to reach sustainability. It's 20 years after we adapt the plan, so assuming it's, let's say it's January 31st, which would be the last day, 2020, then we've got to be sustainable. Although DWR can extend that 2 5-year period, so we might have 30 years if we make a good case. And I think, you know, because as we discussed earlier, as I discussed earlier with Mr. Dice, it's all part of the water balance, even though you're pumping brackish water. So we've got to be in balance at that point, either with an imported water project or whatever. So whether or not we continue that brackish water project beyond that remains to be seen. I mean, it may be at that point, it could be cost effective to continue to use that and recirculate. I mean, maybe take some of that and clean it up and put it back in the system. You know, these are ideas we haven't even begun to discuss, but I would, you know, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know if you want to add anything, Don, but.
I think that's the purpose of the feasibility study is to define how much brackish water we do have in the basin. We know there's brackish water and we have an idea of where it may be, but we don't have an idea of the quantity of brackish water that's available in that feasibility study. The results of that would determine the cost effectiveness of building a plant and, you know, looking at the economics of how long that would last. So that's kind of where we're at.
And there's also the, you know, what's going to happen when we start pumping that and how that's going to affect the dynamics of the system. Are we going to have subsidence, for example? Those are some of the complex issues we have to look at during the feasibility study. We'll be looking at that. And and one other thing I wanted to mention was that since I last came here, the Navy actually has updated our groundwater flow model and has developed a fate transport element to that. So that's another nice aspect moving forward that we have is we'll have a fate transport component.
Can I ask the general manager to identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, for me? State my name? Yeah. Don Zadeba, Z-D-E-B-A.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've just been very interested following the news reports about all the work that's happening in Indian Wells. And, you know, it caught my eye that desalination in Indian Wells is cheaper than on the ocean. You know, I mean, that's the first time I'd heard the concept of having a plant inland like that, and so that was very interesting. So I'm just impressed with you, the creativity and hard work that's going on in Indian Wells to solve a difficult problem. Yeah,
the district's done a lot of thinking on this, and it's been, I don't know, it's been 10 years or more that the brackish water has been discussed. But since Sigma passed, suddenly we got new partners that were very interested in it, including COSO Geothermal, and the pistachio growers and alfalfa growers suddenly are very interested in. And, you know, it's really helped pull the group, the cooperation together, having that added, let's say, stimulus.
Yeah. Thanks.
Mr. Sandell.
Sounds like a lot of creativity.
Yeah.
But do I understand correctly that when you're looking at the balance that you're trying in eventually 20 or 30 years, the amount of water you take out can't be greater than the recharge? Is that the goal here?
Right, but we're also looking at potential for imported water, and who knows what else we can come up with. So
where would that come from?
Well, there's a variety of sources out there that will be looked at, and I'm not part of that study. It's the different group that's doing that. So
I couldn't help notice on your slide 13 that the pistachios were 45% of the nitrate loading, and I assume that means that water that's loaded with nitrate is escaping the pistachio and pistachio trees and getting into groundwater or getting below the trees if you're able to measure it. And so it seems like they're being over-irrigated, perhaps.
I think that it's an ultra-conservative estimate. So we're not sure exactly. We didn't measure it, but we got information from the pistachio growers and then put that into our conservative model.
Oh, okay. So it's likely to be a lot less than this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's still nitrate, but they're not actually running that much water beyond what the trees actually need.
Right. They're drip irrigating, so.
How soon before you all are going to be able to give us an update? It sounds like this is something that's moving pretty quickly, and it would be fun to see. I'd like to see some of the results of using the Danish technology and what those flyovers and charts and graphs look like.
Well, let me just kind of throw out the preliminary schedule we have going. We haven't scheduled it yet, but we're going to be scheduling a public workshop in June to do the initial hydrogeologic conceptual model. Then that's going to go back to the Stanford group, and they're going to the reason the Danish government or Kingdom of Denmark. I like that better. The reason they're involved and offered to fund some of this is because there's some research and development and how to take that conceptualization and do uncertainty analysis. So we have some uncertainty bracketing our understanding of multiple realizations of the hydrogeology. And so that's going to run potentially through August or even towards the end of the year. So that's kind of our schedule for that. Then as far as the feasibility study goes, do you remember when that's scheduled to be completed?
I think it's 18 months, I believe.
Okay, so that would be middle of next year?
Right.
Yeah, so the brackish water feasibility studies looks like the middle of next year. So that's kind of...
Well, I guess we'll just encourage staff to bring us up to date when it seems appropriate.
We'd be happy to follow up with the executive officer's report and work with the water district on some of the information. So thank
Great.
You.
Thanks.
Thank you. I have no more questions. Are there questions from the public? No questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And there is a recommended action.
I'll move that we adopt the plan as proposed.
There's a motion on the floor. Second. Discussion? Roll call vote?
Member Dias, please.
Aye.
Member Horn?
Yes.
Member Sandell?
Yes.
And Vice Chair Jardine?
Aye. We'll push on then to item 11.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lahontan Water Board Annual Enforcement Report.
push button? Okay. Looks like we're ready. Good morning, Vice Chair and members of the board. My name is Scott Ferguson. I'm a supervising water resource control engineer. I'm also the division manager of our site cleanup and enforcement division. And normally Jeff Brooks would be presenting this, but he and his wife are back up in Lake Tahoe enjoying time with their new 2-week-old baby daughter. So I get to present one more time. So this morning I'm going to provide a couple of highlights related to our quarterly violations report for the fourth quarter of 2017. And then I'm going to spend the majority of my time, spend the majority of my time discussing what's new with the enforcement program and how we've gone about developing it. So with that, I just wanted to point out a couple things. And the quarterly violations report is actually located in your agenda package under agenda item number 12, the enforcement or the executive officer's report. It starts at bait stamp 12-99. But what I wanted to point out was in that report, it highlights that between the third quarter and the fourth quarter, we saw a significant drop off in the number of violations. And I wanted to point out the reason for that reduction is that in the third quarter, that is when dischargers with the MPDS, Stormwater Construction General Permit Program, and the Industrial General Permit Program are required to submit their annual reports. So failure to submit your report translates into violations, and that's what we saw the major difference for the high number in the third quarter compared to the fourth quarter. There was another significant reduction that we saw in the numbers that aren't discussed in the quarterly violations report, but I wanted to bring to your attention also. And that is, with our MPDS stormwater annual report submittals or failure to submit, we had 194 violations for failing to submit those reports back in 2016. And in 2017, that dropped down to about 105, so nearly a 50% reduction. That reduction came about through Water Board staff's efforts and their program that they initiated in 2016 to improve compliance with submitting those reports. And the first step in that program is to issue a notice of noncompliance, which is actually a formal enforcement action, but that's what we're required to do through the law or by the law. Where the real work and the progress came in, though, was staff's follow-up with phone calls and a few emails. And it was through those efforts and that activity, that informal enforcement action, that we actually achieved 100% compliance for our 2016 reports. And I think it was also largely due to that communication staff to people that we saw the nearly 50% year over year reduction. So I just wanted to point that out also. And I'm going to stick with this theme a little bit, and it'll carry through, as you'll see, through the rest of my presentation, of staff relying upon phone calls, emails, letters, otherwise informal enforcement action to address many of the violations that we encounter. And I'll point out just a couple of examples that are in the fourth quarter violations report that show how staff has gone about effectively using informal enforcement action recently. So the first example that I would just want to briefly cover was with Fort Irwin's wastewater treatment facility. And they have been experiencing a series of effluent limit violations tied to nitrogen and turbidity. Water Board staff's been working with the facility operator, owner and operator, who is CH2M. And since that engagement, the cause of the violations, the exceedances, has been identified. CH2M has already conducted pilot studies to evaluate potential solutions, and now Water Board staff and them are working towards implementing a solution. The ultimate cause is low alkalinity in their wastewater, and so they're working at to implement a methodology of increasing that alkalinity that works and doesn't cause other problems. So staff's response, or the enforcement activity in response to these violations, has been phone calls, meetings, and emails and letters. So again, all informal enforcement, and it's taken us from identifying the violation, the cause, and now we're on the pathway of implementing a solution. Final example I want to point out is the Burger Basket Restaurant's wastewater treatment facility in Phelan. So now we're going from a facility that's located on a U.S. Army base operated by an international company to now a mom-and-pop restaurant in the high desert. And again, trouble meeting effluent limitations, this time with biological oxygen demand. And Water Board staff approached the owner and, after some evaluation, discovered the problem was a lack of operational oversight. So staff has now, since then, provided technical guidance. The owner has responded positively by hiring a qualified operator for the facility. And that operator is now returning the facility to compliance with effluent limits in coordination with Water Board staff. So the communication keeps going. Again, verbal communication, some writing, emails, and we've gone from identifying what were, I think, in the about 20 daily violations or so in the fourth quarter, to I'm anticipating we'll see full compliance in the first quarter. So highly versatile in its application, and you'll hear how we continue to use it and a little later in my presentation. So those are the highlights of violations and enforcement actions for the last quarter of 2017. And now I want to turn my attention to what has been, there we go, some of the changes that have been taking place within the enforcement program and that are to take place in a little bit in the future. And this is a departure from how we usually present information during this presentation in the past. In the past, we've typically provided numbers and types of violations and enforcement actions and provided some graphs. I want to let you know, excuse me, I want to let you know, excuse me, want to let you know that that information is still available in the write-up of the quarterly violations report, or in the annual report, part of agenda item 11, and it starts with bait stamp 11-7, so it's still there and available for your review. But we've had a lot of positive changes and set ourselves up for improvement. And that's what I really want to focus, and that's happened over really the last 6 months or so. Thank you. That should be better. There we go. And this has come about, these improvements and recommendations, they've come about by work always constantly striving, all of us, to improve this critical program of ours. And so to that effort, about 6 to 9 months ago, Water Board staff started having a couple, two, three meetings with the Water Board's Enforcement Subcommittee again. And that was a subcommittee that was actually created, I'm going to say, about 3 or so years ago. So we re-engaged. We had some meetings, some communication, sharing of ideas. We also engaged with staff from Office of Chief Counsel and from the Office of Enforcement, and we had some real positive interaction there and very productive discussions. So what I'll discuss next is the outcome of those discussions plus some other activities. So the first item I'm going to talk about is that this past fall, as you're aware, our agency underwent reorganization. And one of the outcomes of that reorganization was the combining of the cleanup and site investigation unit with the enforcement unit. And this unit is now under the supervision of Jeff Brooks. And Jeff is also our new enforcement coordinator. He replaced Kathy Poole, who is now supervising our Leviathan Mine unit. And that's also under my division. So there's a lot of positives that I see coming out of this, combining the two units. We're bringing together more staff into a single unit that are bringing in similar, but still some variation among their investigative and enforcement skill sets. And with that additional staff, because before with just the enforcement unit, you had two staff dedicated to formal enforcement actions and stuff. Now we're upwards of, I think, 5 or 6, and they are also doing site cleanup and everything, but we have some additional flexibility, and it allows us to be more responsive. That's what I'm anticipating one of the positive outcomes being. And another new development with the reorganization is, with Lori Kemper's retirement, Doug Smith has been promoted into the assistant executive officer position, and with that, he is now coming over into become the prosecution team leader, replacing Lori in that role. Now, right now, we're in a little bit of a transitional period because Doug's still on the advisory team for a couple of existing cases that we're working on, but as new formal enforcement cases come up, Doug will play the prosecution team leader role for those. So that is a lot of change right there. We have a new unit supervisor, new enforcement coordinator, new assistant executive officer who is also our new prosecution team leader. There is one thing that has remained constant through all this change, and that's my role. I will continue to be a senior member on the prosecution team. I think that will help as I'll be able to bring my experience, historical perspective. I think that it'll also, as we make changes and stuff, I think it'll help improve with continuity and consistency and also relationship building with the Office of Enforcement and other organizations that we work with. So that right there is the reorganization item. And that, for a lot of people, would be enough, but not for us. Another big change, and this is one that is to be seen in the future, but it's what I've termed a settlement agreement workshop. And In the past, settlement agreements have presented a number of different challenges for this organization, for this agency. And my take on the real basic core causes, I think, to some of those challenges are communication and process. And the communication element has been affected by the confidential nature of settlement talks, and that's where we're putting these proposed settlements together, and also with separation of functions. That has divided us up into teams and has put rules in place on how communication can happen. On the process end of it, sometimes the process itself of bringing a proposed settlement before you has varied. And also, there have been times where staff has not allowed itself really enough time to clearly express ideas or have others express their ideas or to fully understand and respond to questions and comments as we prepare to bring an item before you for consideration. So I think with this settlement workshop idea, I think it will address a number of those challenges. So a little bit of what this is. It would be a workshop. It would be held during a regularly scheduled board meeting. And I'm thinking it's going to be for our more complex, controversial, high-value proposed settlements. It's not for everyone. Some of them, as you've seen, have been very simple, very straightforward. I think also with our supplemental environmental project program in place, that helps with the selection of SEPs and has improved our transparency. So I think that whole combination doesn't mean we have to bring everything to you, but for these controversial, complex ones, this is where we're looking at this playing out. And it's really an open forum for dialogue between staff, the discharger, and the board. And it happens out in the open public, and it's an opportunity for the prosecution team to explain what the proposed settlement is, what went into its development, what options we were considering, how it was selected. This is information everybody needs to recognize that would be coming out of the confidential settlement talks. So one step we're going to need to instigate is right up in front when we meet with a discharger to evaluate the opportunity for settlement is let them know this is going to happen in that case, in this case, and this is what it means. We need to be ready to share a fair amount of information that we're about to discuss. We need agreement on that to make this work. So that'll be something we'll be doing as the prosecution team when we first enter into settlement talks. It's also an opportunity for the water board members and the advisory team to ask questions about the proposed settlement. And you can also look at asking the parties to consider changes, to take them under consideration. It's also an opportunity for all the parties to ask clarifying questions. And that will make sure that we have a clear understanding of what each one is saying, which is also critical, as we all know, no matter if it's settlement talks, all aspects of what we do, that kind of communication and understanding is critical. This dialogue also is occurring without the expectation of having to make a decision during this meeting. This would be a standalone item, and if it was necessary to come back to the board, be a separate meeting. And so again, we're taking off that expectation or that push to make some kind of decision. We're just having open dialogue. The one thing also that could come out of it is that the board could ultimately provide direction during these. It's just like any other informational item, and the board can always provide direction to staff. So some of that, and a couple of examples could be, you like how it is, and you direct your executive officer to go ahead and sign it. Others could be, please go back and consider these revisions, and either come back before us or work with the EO. You have a variety of options there on what kind of direction, if you choose to provide such. So I think the outcomes from this workshop will be improved communication, that's good. Improved transparency, that's good. And I think it'll be, even though it may add time, I think it'll be a more efficient and process and give us a better result. Before I leave this, I'll just give you one example and of where looking back, and I'm sure you could think of other examples of how this would have been useful. But just looking back at the Meeks Bay, which is one of the most recent ones at where we came before you with a proposed settlement. And it was definitely an interesting board agenda item. I think the fact, one thing that I think this would have been, that would have been one that a workshop would have been good for. Part of it would have been removing that expectation or push to have a decision, and I think the dialogue would have been different under those circumstances. As I said, there's a number, I'm sure you can think of a number of other ones where you've looked back and said, God, I wish we could have just had a conversation. And that's how I really see this playing out. So that's another big one. And hopefully we won't have to use it that often because we don't have those types of situations, enforcement cases, because everybody's complying. But when we do need it, I think it'll be very valuable. On to a simpler one. Separation of functions, I touched upon it a little bit earlier. When separation of functions was first put out as something we needed to do, I would say we took a very a conservative approach in our application, meaning we applied it to basically most, if not all, of our formal enforcement actions. We've had conversations this past winter with the Office of Chief Counsel and Office of Enforcement. We were all actually in the same room. And after some discussion, it was like, you know what, we don't need to be so broad in our application. And one area where we're going to pull back is with Water Code Section 13267, investigative orders. And this is our bread and butter for going out and getting information under order. It's a formal enforcement action. And going forward, it will be on a very, very rare occasion that we need to separate functions on this. The standard will now be we don't separate, the communication amongst board staff will be more open, a faster process just because of the communication element, and I think a better product, and we'll be more efficient at getting those out when we do need to rely upon them. There's a couple of other opportunities that might be available, and those will be explored in further discussions with Office of Enforcement and Office of Chief Counsel. I'm going to wrap up my discussion today with returning back to where I started, and that's with informal enforcement action. And the slide says, keep on doing what works. We're going to do more of it. And the reason why is that it is what we, as you've heard in previous reports, it does make up the majority of our enforcement activity. And that's not by accident. It works. And it also follows the directive that this board provided about 3 years ago of using the lowest form of enforcement that effectively returns somebody to compliance. That's also known as progressive enforcement. It's also the cornerstone, one of the cornerstones of the State Water Board's enforcement policy. It's laid out there also. So our opening step, with one or two exceptions along the way, will be informal enforcement. And in many cases, that's as far as we'll have to go. I think the reason it's so effective is that Water Board staff are able to approach people that are in violation through their working relationship, because this is our regulatory staff. It's the people that are out there that have created the permits, they're doing the inspections. It's the faces of Lahontan that the regulatory community is used to seeing. And it usually comes across as being one of assistance. It's like, hey, we have an issue here, need to bring it to your attention, let's work on fixing it. And I think with that approach and requesting information or requesting corrective action, I think people don't put the walls up and they listen, more openly listen, and are more open to suggestions and recommendations. And that's why it's so effective. When we get into formal enforcement, you start using words like cease and desist and fines, the walls go up, the negative stigma is there. It's a different environment. So to the greatest extent that we can rely upon informal enforcement, we're going to continue to. To improve our efficiency, we've created a template for our notice of violations, and that's our highest level. The other thing we are going to do is create what I'm calling a library for our staff enforcement letters, and that can be in letter format or an email. That's what constitutes a staff enforcement letter. And these are where we have more license for creativity. With our notice of violation, it's pretty much set in format, content, tone. But with staff enforcement letters, you can really tailor them to the situation. And so you'll see more variety in them. And so I'd like to provide in this library examples linked up with different situations, so that when somebody encounters a certain situation, they can go, oh, John already looked at it and dealt with this with so-and-so and did so effectively, I'm going to follow this lead. And they don't have to reinvent the core letter each time. So they'll have some examples. And again, I think they're effective because we request rather than order with formal. And we always have our formal enforcement there to back us up when we do encounter somebody that just doesn't want to play ball with us. So that wraps up the improvements. And before I open it up to questions and answers, I would like to express my appreciation to the Water Board's Enforcement Subcommittee, and also to Office of Chief Counsel and Office of Enforcement Staff. We've all been working together and interacting, and as you heard last night, seems to be a little more of a collaborative environment with State Board, and we definitely experienced that with getting together and coming to agreement on some of these ideas. I also want to throw out one additional thank you to Chris Kerrigan and the Office of Enforcement. Recently, the enforcement policy was updated along with the Supplemental Environmental Project policy. And we had a number of issues that we were concerned that we might get crosswise, like with our Supplemental Environmental Project program, and there were a couple things with the enforcement policy. And we were able to bring these to Chris's attention and his staff's attention, openly listened and addressed them. We saw the results within the draft, and those concerns were positively addressed in the final product. So again, some good activity, good outcomes, and hopefully more to come down the line. Also, just to wrap up, I want to thank all of you for your continued support and your insight. And it has all helped contribute to our progress on making this enforcement program much better than what it was when we started down this road. So thank you. And with that, questions?
Questions. Mr. Diaz.
No questions. Thank you.
Dr. Horn.
Well, I wrote three things down that I wanted to ask you about, and one of them was, how would this have worked with the Meeks Bay case? So you read my mind. So let's just play that out a little bit, if we could. So I mean, your assumption is probably what we would have heard in the workshop would not be what we actually heard. But assuming that was what we actually heard, I mean, what we actually heard is what came out in the workshop, then how would this work?
The way I think, if we had had this workshop environment, I put it this way, reflecting upon the whole process there, one thing I've seen on a number of occasions is that when the prosecution team comes in and has a proposal, we are putting that out there. And I think, and we tend to be, I think, and you probably agree, defend it. And I think with this workshop environment going into it in the future, we're going to be explaining, but not. I don't see us being in a defend. I don't think we'll be in a defend mode. I would avoid that in the future.
Okay.
That's what, and I think partially with this workshop, number one, it helps avoid that defensive mode by there's no expectation of a decision to be made. We're there to develop the best product, best outcome possible. That's what we're striving for. That's the goal. Not necessarily this is the best thing since sliced bread, doesn't everybody see it? That kind of mode. And I think we've fallen into that trap on more than one occasion. I think this workshop environment will help keep us from falling in that trap again.
Scott, can I add something? Thanks. Doug Smith, the Assistant Executive Officer and the new prosecution team lead. So it's hard to say exactly what would have happened on the Meeks, but what I can tell you looking forward, and to echo what Scott said, and I'll give you just a little bit more detail, if a similar situation arises, what I would do, since I would be the new sheriff in town, is I would come to the board and I'd say, we are going to have a workshop, and the benefit of this is that we have all of the parties in the room and that we can talk about proposals. This is what we're thinking. What do you think about this? What are we missing? And then the board and the advisory team would then have the opportunity to say, hey, you're missing this. What about that? What about this? And then we would say, ooh, we didn't think about that. Let's go back to the drawing board. That's the benefit of this workshop approach.
Okay. So if I may, I'm just curious to ask our attorney for your feelings, pros and cons of this workshop approach and a settlement discussion.
Well, I think some of the pros are what was mentioned, that it helps to manage the expectations of the discharger as well. I think at least my perception is sometimes when a settlement comes to before the board, there might be a misunderstanding about whether or not the board would be in favor of that settlement. And this workshop provides an opportunity for, without a decision looming at that same meeting, for the discharger and for the prosecution team and for us on the board to have a bit more of an open dialogue. There are some difficulties in this approach that was mentioned. Settlement negotiations are confidential, so a discharger would have to agree that some of that information be revealed. This approach might not makes sense for all types of actions. Meeks would be a good example of one that would work, but maybe for something that is a ACL, maybe a workshop wouldn't be appropriate. So it really depends on the case, and I think Scott made a good point that the more complex and controversial, this would be a good opportunity to have more of a dialogue, while some of the simple ones, this workshop might not be needed.
And just my last question, so this idea you have been developing this in conversation with OCC and the Office of Enforcement, both, have they all been in
at the same table, mm-hmm. at the same time?
Okay, and what do you, there not being anyone from the Office of Enforcement here to represent their point of view, what do you hear from them?
We all walk, at that table we had David Boyers, Chris Kerrigan was there for a part of it, and Laura Drabant were there, that was the OE representatives, Elizabeth and Lori Oaken were there from OCC, and we all thought it was a good approach, tackle some of these challenges that we've encountered. I'll just point out one other area where, again, it comes back down to communication and it gets back to this clear understanding. After we have some of these controversial enforcement actions and stuff, on some of them, we do an internal debrief. And it's always, there's always an eye-opening moment in those debriefs where you're like, oh, that's what you were saying. We didn't pick that up in the written comments. We just saw it. We're like, oh, you asked for that. We provided that. We didn't get the underlying idea. And that gets back into, like I said earlier, we don't always allow ourselves enough time to really fully understand what's being asked, because part of the process, once we have a board meeting in front and we're going there for a proposed settlement, we're in go mode, and so we get comments in, we read them, and we're reading them for understanding, but we're under pressure to get responses and get before you. And that's where I think we have failed to see, okay, is there an underlying theme? Or is there something else to this question other than just taking it at face value? And so a lot of, again, communication. And that's what that's why I said it's an opportunity for all parties to ask clarifying questions and really walk away with a good understanding.
Okay, so yeah, that just brings up another question in my mind. So for Elizabeth, in our closed sessions, there is a debate amongst us, and we talk about different criteria that we use in coming to a decision about a case. So would, in your view, that kind of conversation be held in open? I think just to follow on what Scott has just said, I think oftentimes the prosecution doesn't, we haven't, the board hasn't necessarily, we come out and we say thumbs up, thumbs down. We don't necessarily explain to the prosecution team what our criteria have been in coming to that decision, and so maybe that would be more transparent as well in this approach. Or would there be a problem with that?
So I think within that question, I think closed session, we usually go into closed session for ACLs. So for those type of things, I think of the workshop not so much as the opportunity for the board to deliberate on the item, but rather for the board to ask questions. So it's not a vote's not being taken at that meeting, but it's rather for the cases where this could be possible, an opportunity to clarify language, to maybe understand if the discharger's willing to discuss what got them to this point in this settlement negotiation. I don't think of it so much as airing an open deliberation for something that would normally be in closed session.
Anything further?
No.
Mr. Sandell?
No questions.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll move on to item 12, the Executive Officer's Report.
Short break.
I started this with saying good morning, Vice Chair Darty Melchange. Good afternoon, everyone, board members. I'm going to give you an update on the three written executive officers' reports in your packets for the months of February, March, and April. You heard Scott give an excellent annual report and show that progressive enforcement does indeed work, so thank you, Scott, for that. I'd also like to thank the City of Bishop for allowing us to use their facilities. We're very appreciative of that. Our next board meeting is May 16th and 17th in Bishop at the City Council Chambers. We had a number of dischargers and local governments who were not quite ready with their items, so it'll be a shorter board meeting in Bishop, to let you know. We'll have a number of items on Wednesday night. On Thursday morning, we're planning a tour of Benton Hot Springs Restoration Project. This is the Eastern Sierra Land Trust project, and it's very interesting. So that's what we'll be doing Thursday morning, and more details to come. Well, let me start off with my EO report. At the beginning of each month, I give a staff report on the comings and goings of our staff. And you heard Doug yesterday in the priorities and accomplishments explain how much turnover there has been. I'm happy to say I think we're finally ahead of the curve on the hiring. We're almost all done with that and having our staff in place. We'll be working on training, as you heard yesterday, and getting people settled into new programs and reorganizations, like you just heard on the enforcement program. Ben Letton will be our new division manager in Tahoe starting next week. Ben comes to us from the Region 5 Central Valley in the Redding office. He oversaw the Nonpoint Source program as their manager and forestry. He actually supervised their cannabis unit for a time there as well. And he's worked on innovative forestry projects, on watershed-based projects similar to Tahoe West with the Sierra Nevada Conservancy. He's done a lot of grazing work and was working with me on the statewide GRAP project. And he's the Region 5 lead staff person on the federal non-point source permit. And so now he'll be our lead on our side. Region 5 will have to find someone else. Yesterday, sadly, it was Alan Miller's last day. Alan Miller retired after 25 years of employment at Lahontan, and he will be sorely missed. We're going to have a soiree for him later where he's going to play music for us.
And that guy can shred a guitar.
Yes. He speaks of extra time for writing music and playing, so he'll be around the Tahoe area, I think, for those that want to listen to him. And as you heard me say, next year will be devoted to getting our workforce trained, tasks readjusted, and work planning process to start. So thank you for your guidance on the priorities and accomplishments yesterday. Now the hard work begins and we roll up our sleeves. Let me shift to some standing reports. Because I gave you 3 months worth of reports, we have some good standing reports in there that I hope you had a chance to look at. The first is our dairy report. It's on BATE stamp 12-15. And it reports on the 10 working dairies that are out there now, active dairies, and a couple of the closed ones that are under cleanup and abatement orders. Our confined animal general order that you heard about yesterday, I think will make a big difference in our region, dealing with our dairies as well as potentially some of our equine facilities that we have in our region and other facilities, sorted facilities that we have. So I'm looking forward to that going forward from a performance-based target approach. And we're working with our dairy farmers closely and our community and technical experts as we move forward. 8 tribes have already contacted us who wish to consult on this. And with all new initiatives affecting the ag industry, we're going to have to run this draft permit past Department of Food and Ag. We hope stakeholder meetings to begin summer or late or fallish. And as I said before, our 2 closed areas are under existing cleanup abatement orders. I'm now going to move to the South Tahoe Y PCE cleanup. There is a story in there on BATE stamp 12-43. It reports on a February public meeting in Tahoe that we had with the water districts. We're having additional meetings that Scott is organizing with our water districts the next week or so to go over the work plans. The order, the cleanup and abatement order, asked for a work plan after 2 rejections of work plans that were not okay with us. They have submitted a new work plan, which is under review by staff, and that'll be the subject of the meeting with the stakeholders in the next week or so, is to get their input and advice on that. I'm going to try to use some of the lessons learned from PG&E and set some monthly technical work group meetings where we can have everyone at the table, the responsible party, us, the water purveyors, and others, so we really can have a regular discussion as we move forward with the work plan. Based on their input in the next week or two and our staff's review of the work plan, I hope to make a decision on that work plan. I am being told that it's better than the last 2 we rejected, so I'm hopeful. But I'll let that process work itself out in meeting with the stakeholders. But I think the technical meetings will be very valuable. At some point, when the project is further along the way, potentially this summer or early fall, we'll probably have a public meeting where we'll update the public on our progress, and the RP will have to update the committee on the progress. Again, similar to how we do the Hinckley items. We're also going to be exploring to get money from the state board, both with additional investigations, but also to help our water purveyors potentially secure money to help them out. So I'm hoping to schedule a meeting with the state board to explain our path forward on the cleanup and get their help and support on funding in the Tahoe area for both drinking water and any other needs we may have. Let me move to another standing item in your report, and that's on the on-site septic tank lamps. And that's on BATE stamp 12-47, on the heels of you just adopting a lamp today. That's a very good item that staff wrote that gives the history that brought of the board workshops and the status of all of our lamps. This program has been a very heavy lift for both our staff and locals. It's a lot of hard work, but a lot of good information and templates going forward. It'll help improve our groundwater picture on our salt nutrient management plans and on SGMA, as you just heard from Indian Wells. And 33% of our regulatory staff time is spent on lamps in 2017-2018. That came out of the priorities and accomplishments. So when we get through that slug of lamps, I hope by the end of 2018, I think we'll be a better place in our regulatory units and we can maybe breathe a little bit. As a reminder, we've had 4 lamps approved: San Bernardino, Apple Valley, Hesperia, and California City. 6 more to go. That's Inyo, Mono, Alpine, and the cities of Adelanto, Barso, and Victorville. So a few more to go. The board's early policy guidance on San Bernardino lamp has really been instrumental to set the template or the guidance to follow for all the other lamps to come. And so that's really made it go smoother since that. I want to give a thanks to Lori Kemper, to Jay Cass, to Patrice Copeland, to Mike Cooney, and to Rob Tucker, and all others who helped on these lamps. It really was a team effort, and my thanks to all of them for doing a great job. We have a couple of lamps that intersect with other regions, like the Central Valley region, for El Dorado, Kern, Modoc, Sierra Nevada, and Placer County, so we're working with them. Those are moving forward with the Central Valley region. There is an article that's written on bait stamp 12-81 with a more recent update for LA County. That's sort of a unique situation there, where their lamp, I believe, is going to the regional board today for their consideration and discussion in a workshop, but it still needs to go to the county supervisors. And the MOUs for the local governments need to be updated, and that's 41 total local government MOUs. They're going to have, this LA is going to have to update. Two of those are in our region, and that's Palmdale and Lancaster, as well as because of LA County's approach to taking it, it could also affect smaller communities like Pear Blossom and some of the other smaller communities in that area. What that means is for a 7-month gap period, while they sort things out in LA, they go to Tier 1, which means they would have to get a WDR from us. I speculate that a lot of folks will probably wait for that 7-month gap period to proceed with their projects and wait for this to work itself out with LA County. But there might be a few choice projects that need to go forward, so you may see them come to you as WDRs. We're all speculating what may happen, but that may happen. Let me move to a completely different subject, and that's Edwards Air Force Base dispute. That's on bait stamp 12-49. You've heard me say before how trend-setting this is, and you heard me say it the other day in terms of our DOD disputes sadly increasing in California, but this is a nationwide trend. This dispute specifically is about a proposed toxicity criteria rules that are draft regs that they hope to have formalized by the month of May. It involves many chemicals, but the one of interest for this dispute is PCE, even though the toxics reg package covers a multitude of chemicals. We have learned toxics in OEHA that PCE is far more toxic than we originally thought, remains in the body longer. Some subpopulations are genetically predisposed to increased harm, the Asian community, and cancer risk for kidney is increased. On March 28th, I wrote a letter to US EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, supporting the new science and supporting toxics and our sister agencies at OEHA and their draft reg package. We argue that they should be considered as appropriate cleanup standards, and that the science is indeed valid and important, and that California has stricter standards that should be considered. Doug Smith with Mohsen Nazemi traveled back to Washington on March 30th and pleaded our case. Doug did a great job. Mohsen did most of the arguing because it's really their regs that's the center of the dispute. I think it was a very respectful and a good meeting, the staff from USEP had listened very intently and were very open, I believe, from the reports I hear. So they're asking for additional data from toxics and Department of Defense, which they're receiving. They'll take that under advisement, and then we're going to hear back what happens next. So we're in the waiting game now. And that's all we really can do is just wait to see what happens next. But that may influence our other disputes yet to come. I'm going to go now to a different standing item, and that's the city of Barstow Nitrate. As you recall, the board had a separate presentation by staff on that from GSM, and that was rather thorough and gave you kind of a whole overview. So this is really just a written summary of that presentation you received, I believe it was in January, about the Barstow wastewater plant compliance and their phase one plant upgrades and their flow capacity, which they are half using. It talked a little bit about the CAO, and their pilot project that they're working on. I've given 4 CO extensions, and actually I had a very good meeting, Doug Smith and myself, with Kurt from the city of Barstow. about a path forward for us to work collaboratively on the pilot project and the nitrate plume and bottled water for the community. There's an article in your packet on the arson fire at the Barstow pilot project, which has been very unfortunate. We heard from Kurt yesterday that, that it occurred in a couple places in Barstow. It wasn't just at this location, so it was, you know, arson in a couple places. The good news is all parts have been ordered for that repair, and they're underway in getting that repair done. The estimates in my EA report are low. They are now closer to $200,000 to $250,000 in terms of repairs, but those are underway. Replacement water is being provided for 11 of the 35 homes. 10 are below the MCO, 1 is above, just to give you a sense of what's going with that. Another standing item that's in your packet is our grants. This is something that we give you each year on the various grants. And so I won't go into great detail on what those are, because I really want to talk a little bit about the water bond that's yet to come. But we work quite closely with the State Board, both DBOR and Department of Financial Assistance. This, like working with integrated IRWIMS, I think is a very meaningful part of the work that we do. We help with technical assistance to folks. We help them with their applications. We go to funding fairs. We go to IRWIMS meetings and send them information about the latest, greatest news about that there's funding available for this, that, or the other thing. I think it's really been a very important part of the work that we do, that we partner with our folks and tell them where this money is. I constantly are having meetings with whomever will hear. I even tell them about our sister agency funds. Did you know that CalRecycle has money for this? Or so we do try to spread the news on all of our grants. You see that we have 5 non-point source grants that we administer. That's on Bates Stamp 12 Chest 77. There's a chart of those 5 projects. And we are in the next round of the IRWIMP funding under the DWR program, where we have $24.5 million earmarked for the Lahontan region, but that's the entire region of Lahontan. I wish I could have more of the DWR money, but we'll see. We keep trying. I want to mention that in November, before our voters, will be the new water bond. It's $8.87 billion. That's a lot of money. I've seen them in the past be about $4 billion, so this is quite a bit. I have a handout for the board members of some of the highlights of that. Again, it's just a broad brush highlight of what's in there. There are a lot of carve out for special projects in there that I'm not, you know, that aren't in my summary that I think take up a chunk of that bond. But safe drinking water and wastewater for disadvantaged community is $750 million. Wastewater recycling is $400 million. Now, some of these are core programs we have already, and what they're doing is they're just putting more money back in existing programs. So for many of our programs at the water, but that's what you're going to see, is existing programs where they're just throwing some more cash because the demand for all of our money is way exceeding the supply at the State Water Board's Division of Financial Assistance, I could tell you. And as you heard from anyone else, there's actually $400 million set aside for groundwater desalinization. Interesting. So more money from DWR in that area. Agricultural water conservation has $50 million. Stormwater management, $600 million. Watershed improvement, $235 million. Land management for water yield, which is an interesting area, and moving of invasive species, $100 million. Fisheries restoration, $400 million. Groundwater for SGMA, another $675 million to help locals comply with SGMA. Fisheries and habitat, $500 million. And tons more. I can't even, lots of money, if invest special carve-outs. I think we need to spend some time probably reading every single word of that bond to see if there's opportunities for us. Often I find kernels hidden in between the words and other pots. We still have to do that. So that's just sort of a summary of our grant standing item. Another report that's in your packet is on our bacteria recreational policy on bait stamp 12-79. You may recall hearing me in the priorities and compliments declare that the draft policy that's out in the street for the moment does protect our more stringent standards in Lahontan region, and so I'm thrilled to see that that draft has that in there. It's still before the State Board for consideration, so I want to give you an update. There are some new developments on coastal issues and more recent epidemiology studies on using Enterococcus and Totocoliform for coastal that's kind of holding up the whole package. And so it may be punted as far as to November, depending on how they handle that. There's also ideas being suggested that maybe you separate the coastal issues, which will require more public comment and more peer review, from the inland issues, because those are kind of settled, if you will. If that's the path the State Board chooses to go, then we may see resolution on the areas that we care more about sooner than November. But I don't have a crystal ball on how that's going to shake out. Now I want to move to some things that are not in my EO report and just updates, and that's Leviathan Mine. I'm happy to report that earlier this week we got our emergency contract approved by Department of General Services. My thanks to the entire Leviathan team and also to General Services, who I think that took like three-ish days to get through General Services, which is probably a record. So I thank them. But this will allow us to conduct spring pond treatment operations sooner, so we make sure we have room in our ponds so that we do not spill as more water comes off the mountain, and that's very important. And we're all ready to go. We have a contractor ready to go. Some lime already up on the mountain, more yet to go. And we're coordinating closely, as always, with the State Board, the U.S. Forest Service, the Washoe Tribe, and our neighbor in Nevada. So we hope to have operations going in the next week or two, depending on weather and the road conditions, of course, and all those kind of issues. As I think, Mr. Jardine, you just reported there's snow in Markleyville now, so that may take a tad longer. The climate update, I made a presentation, to the State Water Board on April 3rd on what we're doing here in our region on our climate adaptation mitigation strategy, and it was well received by the State Board in terms of the innovation that we're doing here. I think we're ahead of the other regions in terms of action and innovation of how we're approaching it in our region. And a lot of the regions are also borrowing some of the work that we're doing, which I welcome that they do as we move forward. I'm also coordinating a little bit with Region 5 because we share a border so much. There's some issues of like this, and Ben Lutton can help with that since that'll be his new role too. I want to mention some CyanoHab workshops that we're going to do north and south. One is already scheduled for June 24th in Bishop in the Paiute Tribal Center, and that's where we're going to bring experts from the state together, OEHA, others, and train some of our NGOs, our local agencies, on what to look for CyanoHab outbreaks, how to monitor for that. So it'll really be an all-day intensive training, so I'm looking forward to it. One is yet to be scheduled in the south because we're trying to work for on locations and dates, but around that same time, expect one in this part of the region as well. One last update, and I promise I'm done. We have one more workshop at the Mojave Water Agency scheduled for April 24th, and that's our CEQA scoping meeting, and these are the proposed changes to beneficial uses for the Mojave River. As you recall, that came out of the triennial review, and what they are is to remove the cold beneficial use designation below the lower narrows and add the rare and biological beneficial uses for specific locations in the Mojave River and in Deep Creek. So that'll be out for public comment on the 24th, and we hope many will be involved. And actually, during this board meeting, I received a email from the Mojave tribe that they would indeed like to participate at that workshop. And that concludes my EO report, and I welcome any questions.
Questions?
No questions, thank you.
I have one quick question and one request.
All right.
Or maybe that's another question, I don't know. But on the in-lieu fee program for mitigating wetland impacts, I was just curious why these areas were only in Lahontan's North Basin. Why that in-lieu program for mitigating wetland impacts isn't in the South Lahontan region as well?
That's a very good question. It was intended originally as a pilot, so the agreement at the time with the agencies, because there's more agencies in the agreement than just us, they only wanted to try it in the north at first. There wasn't as much interest in the south. There was from us, but not for our other partner agencies and federal agencies.
Oh, okay.
I did try at the time when the MOU came through just to encourage people, but they just want to try. But I think when they see the success of this, when I recall doing the MOU, the southern folks were more on the fence because they want to see how this worked. So as we work out the kinks, I think it'll likely spread.
Okay. Then the other comment I have is, now that our board meetings are, we are having fewer of them in the calendar year, I'm wondering if there's a different way we can do the EO reports so that the board members are updated on a more timely basis. I mean, this time we got a quarter year's worth of information in one big slug. At the same time, we had to read, part of a 3-inch high package of material to read, where some of the material had to do with decisions that we had to make. So, and then, oftentimes if my time is limited, I just don't read the EO reports, particularly, when there's, if I have to triage and decide where to focus my attention. So I'm just wondering if staff could perhaps consider some alternative ways that, where we could receive the EO report information in a more timely basis and not get a huge slug of material just at the board meeting.
We can certainly do that. We can both electronically and in hard copy make it available to you each month each goes. We'll post it on our web for the public to see. We sometimes compile them at the board meeting in case you have questions, so they're there in front of you a second time if that works for you, where I can verbally update you on any updates to those, but we can certainly give them to you each month on a regular interval so that you get them and you can read them each month.
Yeah, so it might just be worth coming back with some suggestions and get board input on what might work best
sure.
for everybody.
Yeah, thank you for that suggestion.
Any further questions? Thank you. I guess we're adjourned.
Oh, you're like, you can't wait to unload that. My homework?
Yes. If you have time, but they know you're traveling.
No, I will. I just.
Password, I changed it. Sync, and I can't get any emails. Tomorrow, I'm working with IT.
Okay.
I mean.
Yes, and there's no just want to let you know, I'm not getting emails. Okay. Yes, the Mojave tribe, missing part of the name. They wanted to, I sent them to ask them to go about what we're doing and invite them. They're supposed to contact
Kathy?
Us for consultation.
I'm going to leave this one speaker.
I'm going to just put it right there. Thank you.
Face to respond if they want to have formal. The law requires you have to give formal, I want consultation. So they just did ask you. I sent the letter out earlier this week.
Okay. There is a tribe called the Mojave, spelled with an H.